Those who in past lives were not enlightened will now be enlightened. There's only one time that enlightenment could ever possibly happen. And you know what that is. Whenever it happens, it's going to happen now. We reach the last day of this 7-day sesshin. And I don't know how it is for those of you who've been sitting since about this time last week or so. But I can't really remember the beginning anymore. I have no idea what I was talking about. I have no idea what it felt like. It was like another lifetime. So some of us might be kind of tired, and but we hope that our zazen can support those coming more recently. And for those coming more recently, please support us with your zazen, your fresh zazen. All together, we all fall off the top of the 100-foot pole, willy-nilly. And our practice is to be okay with wherever we land or don't land. Today we'll, all week we've been celebrating Buddha's great awakening, but this afternoon we'll really do a grand finale. In Japan, for Rohatsu Sesshin, they put an image of Shakyamuni Buddha on the altar for Rohatsu. This one that we have here on the altar, an old Chinese painting called Shakyamuni Descending the Mountain. So usually we have the Buddha like sitting regally under the Bodhi tree, or sitting in his unmoving radiance. But interestingly, in Zen, for the celebration of Rohatsu, Buddha's awakening, we celebrate the Buddha's return to delusion. Don't tell anybody this who's coming for the great awakening ceremony, but secretly you all can know. This great awakening ceremony is really a return to delusion ceremony. That's why the Buddha comes down off the mountain. If you visit the Bodhi tree, it's really, there's no mountain there. But I think it's a kind of an image, an expression for the Buddha kind of going up to the pinnacle of great awakening, and then coming down for the benefit of all beings, willing to live in the world of total chaos for all these beings here in such a world. So we have one more episode at the top of the mountain, though, from the old sutras. The Buddha decided, the Bodhisattva decided to try this new approach, which was to have a little lunch and and gather some soft grass to sit on and find a cool shady spot under the Bodhi tree and relax. Just settle into these meditative absorptions is his way of practicing, remembering his early childhood when he was quite relaxed in the shade of another tree. And so he settles into the present and enters the first jhana, that meditative absorption, the second, the third, and the fourth. More and more equanimous, more and more still. Even the blissful feelings from the earlier jhanas disappear, and it's just like very cool and equanimous and concentrated and still. Usually the description of these jhanas is like there's no usual discursive thinking going on. The mind's becoming very calm and still. I don't think these were practices that were other yogis were practicing in India. But now comes something new. This is the great night under the Bodhi tree. The Buddha says it like this: when my mind was thus concentrated by these meditative absorptions into the present, when my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, it's a flexible, workable mind, malleable and wieldy, and concentrated and bright. I didn't just leave it there, which was, I maybe had done that many times before. The Buddha, I imagine him thinking, I know this kind of stillness, but now with this concentrated, purified, bright, malleable, wieldy mind, I directed it to various topics of knowledge. I think this was the new thing. In that stillness, with no thought, we don't know what happened there. Some curiosity of the Buddha arose. The entire universe in 10 directions conspired to have a little thought emerge in the middle of that stillness of, maybe I should look around here. It's such a nice mind to try to understand what's going on here. My usual mind isn't so good for trying to understand. It's just trying to figure out all this with all these conceptual ideas. And this maybe sounds conceptual because he's describing it, but this is from the launching pad of the fourth jhana, just deep stillness. I directed this mind. In other words, I started using the mind to explore what we call vipassana. I directed this mind to the knowledge of the recollection of past lives. I recollected my manifold past lives. That is, one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births. Many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. There I was so named, of such a family clan, with such an appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan. And passing away from there, I was reborn elsewhere. And there too I was so named, of such a family clan, with such an appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan. And passing away from there, I was reborn here. Thus with their aspects and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. This was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. So this is the traditional story here is there's three knowledges, three wisdoms that arose in the three watches of this, of the famous night under the Bodhi tree. And you might think, that's interesting. One of the three aspects of the Buddha's enlightenment with this past life thing. Like a vision of all these lives. So it wasn't so much about that was particularly about the end of suffering, right? It was more just like a kind of vision of how, of dependent arising, how things work, and the workings of the causal series we call a person that depends on a previous moment of causal series, depends on a previous moment in the causal series, all the way back to our birth. And consciousness seems to be something in this causal series that goes back before birth. So Zen, we don't talk about this dimension of the Buddha's enlightenment so much. One contemporary teacher who practices Zen but is kind of doing his own thing, who I greatly respect as a teacher, Adyashanti. He was, you know, he was one of the types who had the kind of dramatic shift kind of enlightenment. The complete transformation in a particular moment type of enlightenment. And he says part of that experience for him was this remembering of all these past lives. And he's one who is like totally not really like into all the Buddhist stuff. He's not like, he was not religious at all. He's not like a scholar. He didn't study those old sutras. Maybe he heard about the past life thing, I don't know, but it wasn't like a thing that he was into. But he said, I don't know what this was about, but something happened there where I had this vision of something like that. We might say, well, how do you know it was your past lives and not just a vision of some other lives, some random lives, lives in your consciousness? But in fact, isn't that what past lives are, is lives in consciousness? So, we don't know if we, I haven't experienced any past lives that I know of. And yet, I know that I'm influenced by many past conditions, and as we all are, right? We're all unique. What makes us unique? What makes us unique at birth? We're already like kind of a unique personality. What was the conditioning of this uniqueness? So that's one event. Yes?
Somehow or another, this is making me think about evolution. And I don't know from going from apes into consciousness, into a change of consciousness, into what makes us different, a little different from apes. More apes dominate the apes. But anyway, I'm just thinking about the whole evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, and I think it was the change of consciousness was the difference. So,
consciousness evolved. Yes. Seems to have evolved in this world.
When he's talking about consciousness, is he talking about mankind consciousness, animal consciousness? I mean, what kind? Consciousness has evolved and changed. Which kind of is he referring to? Everything was.
It sounds like you know, the particular causal series of Gotama under the tree there seemed to depend on a particular stream, a particular causal series that of course was interdependent with other causal series, but it seems like he's really trying to make it clear to leave no room for thinking, well, I just depended on all beings in the universe, because he says, I was born in this place and ate this kind of food and had this name and had this particular experience and so on. So it sounds like a lineage of consciousness. We say there's no continuous thread of separate self in the Buddha's teaching. But we do say that there's a causal series of consciousness arising and ceasing moment to moment, dependent on the previous consciousness, and then karma goes along with this causal series. And maybe I think the most kind of clear. All this is kind of difficult to understand, I think, but I think the easiest way to understand it is this Yogacara model. We could call it a model of the storehouse consciousness, which was, I think the model was created partly to explain, like, there's no separate self, but there's some sort of constantly changing, dependently arising and ceasing consciousness but that's also connected with particular individual habit patterns and personality and karmic effects. So that's the so-called storehouse consciousness. It's not an entity. It's described as dependent arising, but that each of us has a unique, dependently arisen storehouse consciousness that stores the effects of everything we've ever done and stores the effects of every experience we've ever had. And that, in terms of this rebirth discussion for the Yogacara tradition of Buddhism, they say what is reborn is the storehouse consciousness. But it's not some thing, some entity that's born. It's just a constantly changing, evolving flow, but a unique, particular flow, and that storehouse consciousness gives rise to what we call a body. The storehouse consciousness connects with it's hard to understand this, right? Something about when the sperm and the egg meet, the storehouse consciousness goes there. Even in the early sutras, the Buddha kind of talks that way. Even before storehouse consciousness, he says there's this after this kind of subtle being after the death of a sentient being, and that he calls it a Gandharva, dependently arises with the meeting of a sperm and an egg. And then it gets more and more complex. So it's a model. It's a conceptual story. But the Buddha seemed to have some vision on this night that didn't get that complex. There's no stories about meetings of consciousness with sperms and eggs, but later he tried proposing some things like that. Yeah. Yeah, we could, that's, so we can bring up. Yeah. I think it's very interesting to kind of like, consider the implications of this somewhat modern discovery of DNA in light of these teachings of rebirth, or even like storehouse consciousness. Could be an old-time way of talking about DNA. Weird, huh?
It's information.
It's information, and DNA, what is, like, it's not exactly that the information is stored in this particular particle of DNA, right?
It's expressed from the DNA through processes that are triggered.
But isn't it completely amazing to consider the discoveries of science that are like, nobody understands that, right? How traits from our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents are stored in DNA. And actually, then from this tiny little thing, we grow up and we look a little bit like them. And we talk and think a little bit like them. This is called the mystery. And I think this night under the Bodhi tree was part of the mystery. Yes.
So the sperm and the egg are not random either, right? They're part of this evolutionary process. That particular sperm and egg.
Yeah, because those are the manifestations of two other storehouse consciousnesses called parents. Meet those storehouse consciousnesses meeting through a physical manifestation. Of course, in the Yogacara tradition, they're saying all these physical manifestations, like sperms and eggs that you can like pick up and look at, are actually manifestations of storehouse consciousness. So you could say science is looking into physical processes, but the Buddhas are looking at like, what are the actually conscious workings of this whole process that are maybe, they can function through these physical manifestations. It's kind of amazing. And science puts more emphasis on, it's all completely a physical, mechanical process, and consciousness derives somehow in the sperm and egg, there's a boundless consciousness. I think that's a weirder story than there's a boundless consciousness that can somehow express itself as sperms and eggs. They're two slightly different stories. And one puts consciousness foremost, and one puts materiality foremost. But there's definitely a relationship between consciousness and the appearance of materiality. And the more we think about this stuff, the more awe we can feel, and the more we know we can't get a hold of it. And yet, here we are. We're like sitting in Sashin. I had that thought earlier today, yesterday, like, how strange it is to be like experiencing through this kind of mode of a human being. It's so strange, like, why is it like this? We see the spiders and the ants, and maybe they think that's strange too. They're like, why is this one happening now? And then the ones who start asking questions like that sometimes find themselves in Sashin. they start practicing Zen, and like, to try like, what is going on here? Why, what is this human thing? And like, why is it so much trouble and so much joy, and what should we do about it? let's just sit down for a little while and just try to like stay cool. Yeah, if you get confused about evolution and DNA, just listen to the music play. So yeah, who knows? That image of someone you've never met arose in consciousness for Liz, and what are the conditions in consciousness for that particular image to arise? It's a total mystery. But there were some conditions for that face to arise, right? We just don't know what they were. Could it be that the conditions were someone other than Liz? No. When my mind... What do you say? You want to wait or ask it? Okay, there's three knowledges, we've covered one, under the Bodhi tree. When my mind was thus concentrated, purified, really super calm and concentrated, and still purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. Whoa, the second of three is going to sounds almost the same, but this is a little different here. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and I understood how beings fare on according to their actions, their karma, thus... These beings who behaved wrongly by body, speech, and mind, who reviled the noble ones, who held wrong views, and undertook actions based on wrong view, with the breakup of the body after death, have been reborn in a state of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. But these beings who behaved well in body, speech, and mind, who did not revile the noble ones, who held right view, who undertook action based on right view, with the breakup of the body after death, have been reborn in a good destination in a heavenly world. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and inferior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and I understood how beings fare on according to their karma, their intentional actions. This was the second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. So, it sounds like the first knowledge was about Gotama's, his particular personal lives. I was such and such a person with such and such a name, such and such a face. And the second was just about all beings in general being reborn and dying, not just his own, but the second one is more about how the workings of this cause and effect are all determined by karma and, you know, individual intentions create the results throughout this huge, vast, ancient, twisted realm of sentient beings. So, yes, Richard.
Me
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Six realms in Buddhism.
Yeah. And then the question comes
yeah,
up.
Yeah, non-human worlds. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That you can't think using time as a measure or evolution about what he's thinking about. He's beyond that because he could pop. In other words, these worlds exist with the illusion that this evolution has happened. Maybe. Because I'm saying if all these different worlds exist, let's say as schools or as places you must go where there are a certain set of conditions, then this world we're in has always been this way with what has happened or what has, you know, when we come into it, it's always been this way. But you could say things evolve, you know, that as scientists we know of the age of this universe, blah, blah, blah. But then you have to go to a metaphysical place where he's talking about, and in my mind you have to. There's only a limited number of generations of human beings that have existed on this earth.
Humans, yeah.
You know, that's the...
We might question that in the six-realm model, you know, like we might, from an evolutionary point of view, you could say, a while back there were only five realms because there wasn't the human one, right? Which is I think is true. I mean, a modern Buddha might say that, yeah. Before Neanderthal humans, right, there were five realms. But we also don't know about, we can look at the animal realm and the human as two of six. Those ones we can look at their evolution. The other four are kind of invisible to most people. They're heaven, you know, devas, hell beings, hungry ghosts, and titans. Yeah.
The question is,
they may be evolved too, though.
They evolved, but have they existed forever through various, he said, collapsing kalpas?
Yeah, it sounds like that.
You know, that's just happening infinitely. You know, but then he said even through all that, he's remembering.
Pretty good. I can't even remember the first day of Sashin. It's a vision of vastness, I think, is definitely part of it. And I appreciate, that eons of world expansion and world contraction, which I would also imagine as talking about, like, big bangs upon big bangs, and right? And that I would understand this vision as, like, through all of these universes, there's always been sentient beings, and maybe a whole species, well, we know whole species die out, and maybe all, we know there's been mass extinctions, on this planet, but some kind of sentience dependently, or it can't help itself. It dependently arises and ceases, and it's come down to this. Again, but for our practice purposes, we might take this as, let's just keep a really big open mind, and just let's just realize how much we don't know what's going on here. Science is a tiny little bit at the tip of the modern iceberg, right, of like a very recent thing of like humans trying to understand what's going on here, right? And the Buddha, there was science in Buddha's time in India, much more primitive, but I think sentience, if we say there's always been sentience, maybe part of what comes along with the evolution of sentience is sentience trying to figure out what's going on here. And they do it through science, and they do it through meditation, and they do it in every possible way. Nettie?
Sometimes people do this teaching and interpret it in a way that's not very compassionate, that if
people are poor, it's because what happened in the previous life, and people are rich, because they be different. Could you say how you respond to that in a compassionate way?
Well, how do you feel like that's not compassionate?
Because it's a sort of sign of very individual karma rather than collective karma, not including
collective karma.
Yeah. You know, a whole city can mm-hmm. form, mm-hmm. but you can interpret that teaching as it all is just that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think you answered the question yourself when you said, what about collective karma? I think, and there is teachings like that. I'm not sure if they're actually in the Pali Canon, but there is this kind of old teaching about collective karma, and, you know, maybe this is a huge topic we can't get into, but we might say that collective karma is just collection of individual karmas. So, you know, when a city gets bombed, there's something about people living in a certain area that does have a kind of, like we're all in Santa Cruz, we share this kind of Santa Cruz collective karma. Doesn't it seem? Just by the fact that we're living here. So, if somebody was like, I don't like Santa Cruz, let's bomb that city, it would be something to do with like, well, we're Santa Cruzians, we chose to live here, we didn't think, it's not fair that we got bombed, but what, you know, you could just say it's just inconceivable, the causes and conditions, why we chose to live here, and then why somebody would bomb a place where we live. So it's not unrelated, I think, to individual. Yes.
And then maybe a rock falls.
Yes.
And it affects that stream of water that was
totally
vast, mm-hmm. incalculable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it can work in positive ways too, like the so-called 100th monkey effect. You know about that one? Like, a whole collective area is like on the verge of kind of breakthrough to a new way of being. And, but it just takes one individual causal series called the 100th monkey to start using a tool in a new way or something like this. Right? And then immediately the whole rest of the tribe of monkeys all like knows it instantly. I think it's something like that, is the 100th monkey. Yeah. So it's, and it's mysterious, but we could say it's because of, we could call that collective karma and the collective dependent arising, and so I think maybe also what wouldn't be compassionate is to ever blame anybody for like it's your fault that you're having a hard time because it's your karma. We could say of course that's not compassionate, and it's not really true either, because it wasn't really you in the past life. That even if we felt like something is difficult happening right now due to some past life event, you can't say you did such a bad thing in your last life. It wasn't really me. Like, don't blame me in this life. But of course, me in this life does have some relationship to the one.
Like DNA.
Yeah, like DNA. How dare your DNA act like this to me? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also the, you think of the karma of woundedness,
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whether or not that comes up in the consciousness, mm-hmm. living with the responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Like Einstein, who was this great genius, and I think also really resonated with Buddhism, kind of on the side, said some things like they're really like, I can kind of accord with what they're saying. When he saw what was happening with his discoveries, his amazing discoveries about physics, and seeing how these are, it looks like these are going to be used for like huge destruction, like this nuclear weapon thing. He was so distraught. Like, oh no, we thought this was an amazing thing, but look what humans are going to do with this discovery. Right? Because of human karma. So it's like, Einstein just brings out something that could be used in all kinds of great ways, and then other humans are like, let's harm others. And it's so complex. But also, when you mention time, I think also, maybe part of these visions of the Buddha, and I remember Tenzin Roshi would say, the third knowledge of the Buddha was really the knowledge of liberation, and these first two were like shamanic visions, he calls it. Like, they weren't really about directly about liberation from suffering, but they were about kind of understanding conventional, actually they're kind of about conventional workings of dependent arising, I think the first two. And the time piece is like, maybe we could say, in this one moment under the Bodhi tree, he experienced these eons of time all at once. That's almost kind of a Zen thing, right? Like in Zen they say like 10,000 eons in a single mind moment. It's kind of like that, right? Like that now contains all past and all future. It's a part of his knowledge, yeah.
So we said the third one.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely this was around.
And now I washed them all away.
Mm-hmm. I think that is part of it, is saying all these, the first two visions were about suffering. And they're about, remember his whole quest is about seeking the unborn and the deathless. So the first two visions were all about birth and death, like infinite, uncountable amounts of birth and death. And how birth and death works and so on. So yeah, so the third's kind of like, and now we can see like, I really have a pretty big view now, like the birth and death thing, bigger than I thought. And now, when my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. Or we could also translate as outflow. Asava or ashrava in Sanskrit is the, he says what they are. These outflows of misunderstanding. I directly knew as it actually is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Discovered the Four Noble Truths and this third vision. I directly knew as it actually is, these are the taints, the outflows. This is the origin of the outflows. This is the cessation of the outflows. This is the way leading to the cessation of the outflows. When I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the outflow of sense craving. Craving for pleasure, the outflow of being or existence, and the outflow of ignorance. These are the three outflows that have an origin, a cessation, and a path to their cessation. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge, it is liberated. My mind is liberated. I directly knew birth is destroyed. The spiritual life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being or existence. This was the third true knowledge attained by me. In the last watch of the night, ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. So this is the three knowledge description of Buddha's great awakening. We often don't hear it talked about that way in the Zen tradition. Maybe a little bit like this not becoming anything aspect. But I think I mentioned on some earlier day, it looks like also this emphasis on enlightenment in the old foundational sutras is so much about ending like a craving, either for some experience that's not happening right now, or craving to just exist. Craving for sense pleasures, craving for being, and craving for non-being, or a craving to not exist, is another part of this wanting anything at all. And whereas Zen enlightenment seems to be more about like non-duality, like just realizing the non-separation or non-duality between self and other, between mind and object. So in that way, I thought they sound kind of different. Where is non-duality in the early teachings? We can find it, but is it the content of the Buddha's enlightenment? But then, you know, in this Bhikkhu Bodhi's book here, it says there might be more too, but the other kind of main description of the Buddha's night of enlightenment sounds a little different in the early sutras. And this one, I think, is a little bit more about non-duality. So it's interesting he describes it differently at different occasions, or the sutras do. But this is the, you know, the early scriptures, talking about the 12-fold chain of causation, which I think many have heard about how suffering comes to be dependent on various factors that are dependent on various factors. We could say a causal series of experiences that lead up to suffering. And here it's not exactly the 12-fold chain, it's like a 10-fold chain. But the interesting part, without going into the whole 12-fold chain, is the Buddha's meditating here, and he's saying, by what is name and form conditioned? So name and form is, form is usually defined as the great elements, earth, wind, fire, and water, or like materiality, or the body. So kind of like the physical world. And name is generally refers to these other skandhas, like feeling and perception and formation. So three skandhas plus form. Without getting too into it, let's just say name and form is like the world and body, feelings, perceptions, and world, I think is maybe an easy way to understand. So what is this body, world, and feelings conditioned by? Then monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is consciousness, then the body, the mind, and the body, the world, and the feelings come to be. These body, world, and feelings have consciousness as their condition. Then monks, it occurred to me, when what exists, does consciousness come to be? By what is consciousness conditioned? It's kind of a usual 12-fold chain thing. And in the 12-fold chain, you go back to karmic formations and ignorance. But in this case, by what is consciousness conditioned? Monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is name and form, body, world, feelings, consciousness comes to be. Consciousness has this body, feelings, and world as its condition. And where does the body and world have its condition? Consciousness. And where does consciousness have its condition? The body and the world. And where does that have its condition? Consciousness. So it's a loop, right? It's like usually the 12-fold chain is like a line that goes down to the bottom and kind of ends sort of with how it's depicted. This one goes down to like link number 10 and then starts spinning. And like a yo-yo, yeah. And when I read this in earlier in Sesshin, I had seen this before, but a couple of days ago in Sesshin, like I started getting goosebumps, and like I'm like, wow, this is it. This is the non-duality piece. So he goes on later in the sutra. Then it occurred to me, I have discovered this path to enlightenment, awakening. That is, with the cessation of name and form, this is, we could say the cessation of our experience of body, world, and feelings as objects of consciousness. With the cessation of that comes the cessation of consciousness. Here, consciousness, we're talking about the dualistic consciousness that knows objects. It's vijñāna. With the cessation of this dualistic consciousness comes the cessation of the body, mind, and the feelings. With the cessation of the body, mind, and feelings, there's the cessation of the six senses. And with the cessation of that, the cessation of contact, the cessation of feeling, the cessation of craving, the cessation of grasping, the cessation of becoming, the cessation of birth, the cessation of aging, sickness, and death. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Cessation, cessation. Thus, monks, in regard to things not heard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, awareness, and light. So, it's a little bit complicated to understand this, I think, but I hear it as Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his footnote, says this spinning part of like, kind of like, the objects of mind and the consciousness that knows them are dependent on each other, and there's no beginning. He calls that this interplay of consciousness and the objects of experience is a hidden vortex underlying all existence in samsara. Whew. That's Bhikkhu Bodhi. That's a good one. So, in other words, like, that's duality. The illusion of there's a consciousness, as a subject that's aware of these experiences as object, and they dependently arise together. That's called duality. And we see that, if one ceases, the other ceases. That's like the cessation of duality. So, that's a little more clunky and technical sounding. I think very precise compared to Zen saying, just drop off body and mind. But maybe related. Something to explore. Anyway, let's go back to Zen. In a kind of contemporary Zen, talking about enlightenment or awakening, the unstoppable Zen teacher Kodo Sawaki Roshi once said something like, wanting to become a Buddha or wanting to attain awakening through Zazen is like somebody traveling on a train going home and who starts running in the train because they want to get home faster. Good one, huh?
What is that green?
So wanting to attain awakening through Zazen is like somebody who is being carried home effortlessly. But because they want to get home faster, they start running in the train, like making all this effort to get there faster, to get there faster, for being completely supported already. And Suzuki Roshi, some of us just finished reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and the epilogue there. In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi, surprisingly to me as we read it, talks about enlightenment a lot. He uses the E word quite a bit. And I think a lot of what he's saying is don't seek enlightenment. He's really into this non-seeking thing. Here in the epilogue, at the end of the book, he says, enlightenment experience is, he says, or the translator, it's not a translator, he's speaking in English, but the words are to figure out. So if I was an editor and I said, did he really mean enlightenment experience is to figure something out? But that's how it ended up in print. But if enlightenment experience is to figure out, but to understand and to realize, we might drop out off figure out and say enlightenment experience is to understand, to realize this mind which is always with us and which we cannot see. And then on the next page, I think he says, at least we must have some enlightenment experience. You must put confidence in the big mind which is always with you. You should be able to appreciate things as an expression of big mind. This is more than faith. This is ultimate truth which you cannot reject. So, there's a little piece about enlightenment from Suzuki Roshi. Yeah, it's because to carry the self forward and experience enlightenment is delusion. But myriad enlightenments coming forth and experiencing themselves is enlightenment, we could say. He also says something, I think about enlightenment's not like going on a date. Like if you want to like have a date with your girlfriend or boyfriend, actually it's, instead of calling them and arranging to meet at a certain spot, that's kind of troublesome. Why don't you just do your usual routine and get up at your certain time and have some meals and then like go to that corner where you've often met her and she'll just be there. And you don't have to like make some arrangement beforehand. You just get used to like if I take care of my life like this and keep going to the same place, she'll be there and you'll be very happy to even just catch a little glimpse of her. But if you try to say like, will you meet me there at a certain time, then it's kind of like it becomes kind of a burden on her and you. That's a good one, I thought, too.
Good luck with the Western psyche in that way.
This is about enlightenment we're talking about, right?
It makes me think of Castaneda's Don Juan. That's kind of, I would think that's how he would be someone.
Mm.
If you think you're ready with Don Juan, you know, mm-hmm. Sorcerer.
Just be there and there. Meet.
Mm-hmm. Or don't be there. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be ambushed or whatever.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Remember, here we're talking about a date with enlightenment. Right? He's just giving this parable as with your girlfriend, boyfriend. But actually, what's that?
It should be. A date with enlightenment and a date with your girlfriend should be the same thing.
Yeah, it should be the same thing. We don't want to burden either one. by forcing them to come and say like, at 20 minutes into Zazen, enlightenment, you better be there. We just practice and show up 20 minutes into Zazen at a regular routine and she'll just be there. And if she's not, sometime, that's okay too. If we're too forceful, like, we always have to meet there at that time, then she'll, like, you're pressuring me too much. And she won't show up.
No, so. I always liked it, and I always remember what Carlos says, Don Juan, well, how would you avoid, I know you don't get into fights and you don't get killed, how would you avoid going down a road and being ambushed? And he said, I wouldn't be going down the road.
Yeah, it does. Dogen's great Satori essay, Daigo. He brings up one last story. Remember, the first story was that he commented on was Lin Ji saying, in all of China, it's hard to find a single person who's not awakened. The second story was all about how is it when an awakened person returns to delusion. And this third story is Reverend Mi Hu of Jingjiao had a monk ask Yangshan. So Mi Hu and this monk were both disciples of Yangshan. So these kind of two Dharma brothers. One said, "Can you go ask our teacher this?" People nowadays, do they still need enlightenment or not? Do they need Satori or not? And Yangshan said, it's not that there is no enlightenment, or it's not that they don't have enlightenment, but they can't help falling into the secondary. Or other ways to translate this are, people of the present time, do they still avail themselves of awakening or not? And Yangshan said, it's not that they don't have awakening, but they can't help falling into the second rate. It's translated here. Literally, it's second head. The second head, but I think it's maybe kind of a Chinese expression of like second thought or something extra, like a second head in addition to your own. But I think secondary gets at the meaning. Some people actually translate it as duality. They can't help falling into duality. Another way Kaz Ta-Nehisi translates is this character for need. Do they need awakening? Ka is also means to need or to avail of. Do they avail themselves of it? Or do they need to rely on it? Do people these days depend on or rely on enlightenment? Or another way, that's a little different, but it is a meaning of this character, is pretend to have, or pretend. So, I think Kaz puts it as, do people nowadays pretend to have enlightenment? And Yangshan says, it's not that they're not enlightened, but how can they avoid falling into the secondary? It's a little different meaning, I think, but they're somewhat related. Do people these days need awakening or not? It's not that there is no awakening, but what can be done about falling into the secondary? Secondary here, I think we mean like some idea about awakening. People have awakening, but how can they avoid falling into some thought about it that kind of isn't it? I think that's the gist of the conversation. Do people these days need awakening? It's not that there is no awakening, but what about falling into the secondary? Or what about falling into duality? What about falling into some idea about that? It's not that there is no practice in realization. It's just that they can't be defiled, so we shouldn't defile them. So, this one Dharma brother asked the other, ask our teacher that and see what he says. So Yangshan says this, and the monk returned and reported this to Nihu, and Nihu appreciated it, or agreed, or assented to this answer. Like, nice, thanks for checking that. Our teacher got it just right. So here's Dogen's comments. The present time spoken of here is every person's present now. People of the present time, people nowadays is everybody's present now, right now. Shakyamuni Buddha's now, where he saw eons of world contraction and expansion, he saw them all right now, and that time of Shakyamuni seeing that is right now, isn't it? There's never anything time other than now. And so Dogen's reminding us that we might say people of the present time in Tang Dynasty China, but actually we're talking about now. People nowadays. The past, futures, and presents that are allowed may be thousands, myriads, but they are always the present time, the present now. Where we are is invariably the present time. Or we could take the eyeball as the present time. Or we could take nostrils as the present time. Which is, these are these two Zen expressions we talked about. Dogen has a whole essay called the eyeball, Ganze. And also the Zen people always talk about nostrils. Like if somebody gives a bad answer to a Zen question, they say, he has no nostrils. It's a weird one. I think it's maybe something to do with vitality and breath. But also I think maybe also that it's the part of our body that doesn't exist. It's just empty space. It's empty space, but life is given to us through this empty space. I don't know why they say nostrils, but it's one of those Zen sayings. But also, eyeball and nostrils are, of course, two of the physical senses. So I hear it, and I think some commentator mentioned that it's almost like a double meaning. There are these two Zen expressions for the ultimate awareness, and the two expressions for ordinary sense perception. And both imply now. Sensory experience always happens. We're always seeing and smelling now. So, yeah. Interesting. Probably Dogen didn't know that, but maybe he felt it. Yeah, and that's another good reason now that we can call Zen people nostrils. So yeah, it's we could take eyeballs as the present time, or we can take nostrils as the present time. So this question, do people these days need awakening? Dogen says, quietly study these words. You should switch them for your heart. You should switch them for your head. In other words, like, these words, do they still need awakening? We should take that word and put it into our heart. Change it for our heart. Take our heart and put it on the page, and take the sentence and put it in our heart, or put it on our head top, on the crown of our head. In other words, like, really just sit with this question for a while. Do people these days need awakening or not? Recently, bald-headed ones in the land of Great Song China, which is one of Dogen's kind of disparaging terms for those ignorant monks. Shavelings, it's translated here. Shavelings. Is that a word? they say, those ones say, awakening to the way is the basic expectation for us, shavelings. So saying, they vainly await awakening. Well, that's what we're doing here, Zen people. It's all about awakening, so here we are. Come on. Awakening. But remember, practice and verification are not two. So we can't just sit there and wait. We have to practice. And a moment of practice is a moment of verifying awakening. So they sit there vainly awaiting awakening. Nevertheless, they seem not to be illumined by the radiant light of the Buddhas and ancestors. Given over to laziness, they miss the fact that they should just study with a true good friend, a teacher who can point out what awakening is about. Even if the old Buddhas appeared there, they still probably wouldn't attain liberation. The words, do they still need awakening or not? Do not say that they don't have awakening. They don't say that they have awakening. They don't say that awakening comes. They don't say any of these things. They say, do they need it or not? It's like asking, how has the awakening of people these days been awakened? Or how is it actualized? For example, if we say that they get awakening, we wonder whether previously they didn't have it. Which is kind of like running in the train to get it. When we're being carried by the train. If we say that awakening has come, we wonder where it was until now. I just arrived, awakening. Where was it before then? That's a good one. Sometimes we might have moments of understanding and kind of look back and think like, maybe that can come with moments of insight sometimes, is how silly I was running in the train. You know, I was looking for something, but it didn't come from anywhere. It was always here. Many Zen stories are like this, right? And then we don't have to get really... I think if we then get really down on ourselves and feel like, I wasted so much time, that was so stupid, all that pointless effort, that's a little too much, right? That's a little bit like, we're now losing it again. we're getting too into like, my true separate past self was bad. Something like that. It's more just like, we could just laugh at ourselves maybe and just be like, yeah, maybe I could call it wasting a bunch of time, but it all led up to right now, so there's no problem. It's okay. Because it's all okay. Isn't it? He said it's like, it's mostly okay, but are you sure about completely? So, let him do his thing. If we say that awakening has come, we wonder where it was until now. If we say they have become awakened, we imagine that awakening has a beginning. he does not say it like this. Yangshan, I think. Yangshan's not like this. Yet when he speaks of how awakening is, he says, oh, actually it's this, it's the monk asking Yangshan. When he speaks of how awakening is, he says, do they need it or not? Nevertheless, we can speak of awakening. However, since he said, what about falling into the secondary? He's saying that the secondary is also awakening. Yeah. Wrestling like this. We maybe could have guessed that Dogen would say such a thing at such a time to such people. Which is a lot like, I think yesterday we heard only a Buddha and a Buddha. But Dogen said, although realization is not like any of the thoughts preceding it. This is not because such thoughts were actually bad and were not realization. Past thoughts in themselves were already realization. But since you were seeking elsewhere, you thought that those thoughts could not be realization. It's the same principle to say that the secondary must also be awakening. In other words, the thoughts about this is awakening that's are often criticized in Zen. We're kind of making it into something. But that thought, yeah, this is awakening, just like this, and we start to feel it melting and withering and wilting and like, what was that again? Oh yeah, it's just some idea I just had. But this is like, some idea I just had, and even feeling of withering is all awakening. Really big, big perspective here.
I thought about awakening. Maybe there's another, that's perfectly, let's accept that word, and then how about maybe there are other ways of looking at it, not using that word.
Yeah, we talked about earlier in Sesshin, lots of other words.
I mean, for example, we all have potential in any number of things, and they differ, that's not, but we all, and the way that you become, the way those become developed is through practice.
But that sounds...
There is
that description, yeah, and but it's still a little bit like something needs to be done. Something could be like the potential needs to be manifested still, right? Yeah, and I think that's true from a certain perspective. And I think when Dogen's like kind of digging down further and further into non-duality, I think that he is trying to get to the place where nothing even needs to be done.
So that could just be
each thought.
Effortless.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Things are getting done, but you don't really have to do effort.
From a certain perspective, things are happening, and from another perspective, nothing's happening, and it's always been okay. Yeah, so both are true. But here when we say, this very thought of this is awakening, or this isn't awakening. Those thoughts, how could they be something other than the true nature of reality? Which is, I think, the particular twist in this essay of great Satori. Satori really means like understanding or awakening or realization. But Dogen's talking about it as not some particular understanding or realization or awakening in addition to reality as it is and as it always has been. And then why are we talking about suchness as an understanding? So that's the dynamic thing here, that it has this name, but Dogen's going further back down to, it's not even about a particular understanding, and yet as we heard earlier, Dogen said, there can be a bit of a bit can be added where there's already a lot, which could be like we could actually have some understanding where there's already fullness. There's a little hint. Oh yeah, there can be adding a bit where there's a lot and taking away where there's little.
And the taking away and a little refers to extra?
Yeah, could. Yeah, a little could be like, yeah, not, like, there's not very much, doesn't seem to be very much awakening here. Be one way to hear it. There's very little awakening, and there's just delusion, yeah. And then taking away a little would be like, that, you know, reifying that or thinking that this isn't very much. It could be one way to hear it. And adding a bit where there's already a lot could be just like, not adding a thought about a lot, but just adding a verification of a lot. One way to hear that. Of course, Dogen leaves it up to us to interpret. So I think that is also one of the great sentences, is that the secondary is also awakening. Or duality is also awakening. The secondary is like saying, this is the conventional meaning of secondary. Secondary is like saying, became awakening, in quotes, or get awakening, in quotes, or awakening has come, in quotes. Those are like secondary ideas, right? He's saying that became or has come are also awakening. All these things in quotes, all the thoughts that we can have about awakening are also awakening. Therefore, while lamenting the fall into the secondary, it seems that he actually eliminates the secondary. Or one may also think that the secondary made of awakening is the real secondary. So this secondary is made of awakening, or the nature of the thought is the nature of awakening. That's what it's really made of. One may think that the secondary that's made of awakening is the real secondary. Therefore, though it may be the secondary, though it may be 100 dairy or 1,000 dairy, you know, it, remember here, it's in Chinese, it's second head. So it may be 100 head or 1,000 head. We might take it as like a thought about 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 a thought. Like, this is it. There it is. This is awakening. Oh, no, I'm not supposed to do that. It's the secondary. Oh, no, but I'm doing it even more. No, why don't you just stop? Stop thinking. What? That's another one. What do you mean? Ah! Have you ever had zazen like that? That's like 100 heads. He's, so 100 or 1,000 heads. It should still be nothing but awakening. Although however many heads you add on, however many thoughts upon thoughts, they're all awakening. It's not that since there is this, a secondary, that some prior primary is left behind. Right? It's not that when you have the thought of awakening about the inconceivable, ineffable, unspeakable awakening, that the ineffable primary awakening is left behind. Right? It's not when that since there's a secondary, some primary is left behind. like the when you see the vase in this optical illusion, it's not that, and say that's the vase, it's not that the two faces are left behind, they're still there, but you're just looking at the vase, that's this thought, this is awakening. But the vases haven't gone anywhere. It's a shift of perspective. It's not that this would be, for example, like saying that while we take ourselves yesterday to be ourselves, yesterday's self takes today's self as a secondary person. That's kind of hard, huh? This would be like saying that while we take ourselves yesterday to be ourselves, yesterday's self takes today's self as a secondary. The present awakening, we do not say, is not yesterday's. It has not just begun now. That's how we study it. Therefore, awakening's head, remember, this is all about the second head here, so it's a kind of a word play. Awakening's head is black. Great Awakening's head is white. So, of course, Dogen does all this word play, right? So it's playing with this idea of the second head is the secondary. Like there's this story where a monk asked, why did Bodhidharma come from the West one time? And Jijang said, I have a headache today and can't explain. Can you go ask our brother Baijiang? And so he asked Baijiang, why did Bodhidharma come from the West? And Baijiang said, at this point, right now, actually, I don't understand. And the monk went and reported that to the teacher of all three of them, Matsu. And Matsu said, Jijang's head is white and Baijiang's head is black. Which is a Zen koan. Sometimes we, like in the merging of difference and unity, right, we talk about darkness and light as the black darkness is like the ultimate and the white is the relative world where we can see all the 10,000 things. And those are merged difference and unity right there, not two different realities. So, in this case, just saying what's happening. I have a headache today. Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? I have a headache today. It's just like, that's what we can see, right? That's what we can, that's just what's happening, appears to be happening. Is there any other reason why Bodhidharma would have come from the West other than, headaches and lunch in the Zendo and stuff like this? It's kind of like his head's kind of white and his brother, he said, I don't understand at all. That's kind of like black darkness. So one's head is white and one's is black. Came and he sat and he left.
Did all that stuff.
All that stuff.
With no wife.
It almost seems like he didn't even do that much, really. He just sat there without moving for 9 years and left. But Great Awakening's head is black. We have no idea what it is. And Great Awakening's head is white and sometimes has a headache. And he's getting really tired of hearing all this Zen stuff. So, like, let's wrap it up. Great Awakening. Now you have it, so keep it well.
I'm feeling better about my headaches.
Makes it all worthwhile if Richard feels better about his headaches. The Sesshin has been a grand success, not just for Richard, but for all of us, whether we think so or not. So, in that case, may our intention equally extend to every being and place throughout vast world systems of contraction and expansion, throughout space and time, to all sentient beings undergoing birth, old age, sickness, and death again and again. May our intention equally extend to all of them, past, present and future, with the true merit of Buddha's great awakened way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.